So, well, we will start. My name is Dan DeWitt. You've met me already, so I won't say much about myself other than I'll introduce my family. They're not here, but I'll tell you who they are. So my wife, April, we've been married for over 12 years, and we have four children. We have twin boys who are seven, Micah and Isaiah. We have a third son who's 3 years old. His name is Josiah. And then we have a daughter who's 11 months old, and her name is Adeline Joy. And we live right on campus here. So when I accepted this job, which I was as surprised as anyone else, perhaps more, that I was becoming dean. I never really sought to do that. I've worked around the seminary for a long time, but when they asked me to become dean, I was leading a campus ministry at the University of Louisville. And the name of that ministry was the Campus Church. And we had started it 3 years prior to when I became dean, which is now 3 years ago. And I went into it with the idea that we would just kind of set up shop, put a banner out on campus, pass out some cards. A lot of people would come and get saved, and it would be awesome. That was kind of what I thought it would look like. And it was, we had a very different response. The people who came to the campus church were primarily skeptics. And so we had, and just to give you one example, we have one worship service where there's an atheist sitting on this side who is a good friend and still is, and is still an atheist. He had committed to come to our worship services every week for a whole year. He made that commitment. He came, we did an event with Dr. Moeller. Dr. Moeller spoke. His name's Nick. He asked a question. It was a really informative question. I went up to him afterwards and asked him about his previous religious experience, because he said he had a religious experience growing up or some religious affiliation. And it was a pretty, he came from a pretty nominal Catholic family, and they went a couple times a year. And so for him to walk away from that, I said, you know, you really haven't experienced the vibrancy of a faith community on an ongoing basis. So he committed to come for a year. And so he's sitting on one side. I actually would use him. You guys can come on in. There's, in fact, if everybody keep moving over and make some more seats, and I don't know what else we'll do. Here's a few here, two there. Yeah. If you have, yeah, if you have an empty chair, fill it and open up a spot on the aisle. So anyways, I went to him and said, Nick, why don't you come? And he made the commitment to come every week. We did a blog together called the Christianity Dialogue. And he would just every week blog about his experience. But I would use that with my Christian students who would come to our ministry. And I would just tell them, you know, the atheist was here last week. Where were you? And so that would sometimes put them in their place. Were you asking a question? I thought I heard somebody say something. Feel free to interrupt me. I'm a little scatterbrained anyways. And our ministry, actually, during the semester breaks, we would meet in a coffee shop. And the coffee shop would stay open for business while I preached. And so that was interesting, too. That's the closest to open-air preaching I've ever been, to just stand there and be preaching, and people would come and go. And it's pretty unique. So this one worship service, Nick is there. And there's this young couple who just came in for their first time. And I see them, and I think these have got to be Christian kids. Like, they're nodding their head. They just seem to be into what I'm saying. And I thought, either they are seekers and God's working in their heart, or they're believers. And they came up to me at the end of the service, and they said, we're somewhere between you and Nick. We're deists. And that was a new one. I hadn't met a real live deist. I mean, I've read about them, Thomas Jefferson and people like that. But to meet somebody, to say I'm a deist, that was unique. And that was just the nature of our ministry. We had the Secular Student Society invited us in. They gave us 2 hours to talk about the historicity of the resurrection. They met the next week for another 2 hours to talk about everything that we had shared with them. We co-sponsored a debate. It's pretty interesting. And all of our leaders went out because we're all friends. And after this meal, those of us who weren't friends got to know each other. We went out for dinner together, came back to U of L's campus. They brought in a speaker. We brought in a speaker. And we had about 350 students there, most of whom were skeptics. And it was just a really unique environment, and I loved it. In fact, my wife and I were walking down the street one time, and there's a couple college kids, and we hear, Dan, April. And so they're all excited, and you would think it was like a couple of our kids from our youth group. And they were atheists. They were people we got to know on campus. And I just really enjoyed that and felt like the Lord had opened up this opportunity for a season of time. In fact, the first sermon I preached there at the campus church was a sermon called What I Love About the Gospel, which has over the years turned into a little book that just came out that I think you guys got a copy of, Jesus or Nothing. And that actually goes back to that campus ministry. But when they asked me to become dean, this is really the polar opposite. To go from being kind of a minister to skeptics to the dean of a Bible college, it was about as big of a difference as you could possibly get. But we really feel like the Lord was involved in it. And we've loved the opportunity to be here. And I still keep skeptic friends and have opportunities to dialogue with them on a weekly basis. So my wife and I moved to campus. We live really right on campus. And it's a real joy of ours to invest in students who are going out to be leaders. And when I first got here to Southern years ago, I loved C.S. Lewis like every Christian loves C.S. Lewis, which means I didn't know him very well, but I thought I knew him really well. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm like, oh, I love him. He's my favorite author. People could ask me, what have you read by him? I watched the movie, the Narnia movie. You know, I'd read a couple things by him. But I really, you know, I was more talk than anything because that's, you know, it's part of hipster Christianity. We love coffee and C.S. Lewis and, you know, True Religion jeans or whatever. So I signed up for a book club at our area Borders bookstore. We lived in J-Town, the area of Louisville. It's called J-Town. And they were having a book club reading on Screwtape Letters. So I signed up for Screwtape Letters. And I actually had read that one years ago, and so I picked up, but I didn't have a copy of it, so I picked up the signature series of C.S. Lewis, which has several of his books and had Screwtape Letters in it. I read Screwtape Letters. I developed my own theory of what was going on and Lewis's life, and I was so excited about this club. I showed up prepared, and I was the only one there. And so I sat there all evening and sipped cappuccinos, and I read from C.S. Lewis, some of his other works. And I just really fell in love with the careful Christian thinking that C.S. Lewis offered. And so since that time, I've read most all of his apologetic works, most of his fictional works, and the part of the Lewis corpus, the body of writings that I'm still working on is his literary stuff, which is really, his area of scholarship was medieval literature, and so that's what I'm still working through, but I've read most of what he's written, and much of what he's written I've read over and over again, which is, if any book is really worth reading once, it's usually worth reading twice. And as C.S. Lewis once said, that every major book that's impacted you, you should read on an annual basis. And so I read Mere Christianity over and over again. And so I went to Dr. Russell Moore, who's the provost of the school at that time, and I said, can I teach a class on C.S. Lewis? There are no classes here on C.S. Lewis. And so he let me teach a class, and I'm teaching my first class, and I start getting emails and invitations to write about C.S. Lewis because I'm a C.S. Lewis scholar now. And I'm like, if you only knew, you know, here's me sitting in the coffee shop going, this is good stuff. I've not read this before. And I had the opportunity recently, Dr. John Piper did a conference on C.S. Lewis, and I got invited to do one of their breakout sessions because I'm an expert on C.S. Lewis. And I'm like, I'm just teaching a class. And so I love it. If you were here, if you were a part of my class, I cap the class at 20 students and I teach it in my office and I take all the furniture out and I just sit at my desk and it's a real close, I have a pretty big office because it's an old building and they used to build offices big and nice. We don't do that anymore. It's not, you know, efficient, but we crowd in and it's a lot of fun. This summer we went to England and I was able to teach the C.S. Lewis class in his home, which was really neat. So we went to what's called the Kilns. C.S. Lewis had a nickname for everything. And so the nickname for his home was the Kilns. And so we went in there and took a tour of his home. We went and sat in the pub, didn't consume any alcoholic beverages, just to clarify. But we went to the Eagle and the Child pub. C.S. Lewis also had a nickname for that. It's a, you know, a pub name, the Eagle and the Child. Why do you need a nickname for that? But he called it the Bird and the Baby. And it looks like there's some folks outside. If we could try and, I don't know how we'll, if you would open the door for him, we'll try and let him in. Hey, there's not a lot of chairs, but if you guys want to come find somewhere to, you can sit on the sides if you're not comfortable doing that. Guys, if you want to give up a chair for a lady, thanks, Matt. Great. So anyways, that's kind of my background with C.S. Lewis. Last year I published an article that I'm actually going to talk a little bit about today with Christianity Today. on why C.S. Lewis didn't write for Christianity Today. Their very first issue, they asked C.S. Lewis to write for them, and he told them no. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about why C.S. Lewis didn't write for Mere Christianity. But what I want to do mainly is talk about three of his, what I think are Lewis's main apologetic devices that you see throughout his writings. But before I do that, let me hear from you. What's your favorite C.S. Lewis book? Anybody want to share a favorite? Yes. Screwtape Letters. Yeah, they're great. They're great. They were originally published as individual letters in a magazine. And so there's 31 of them. And if you want to read Screwtape Letters, you could literally just read one a day, and in a month you'll have read it. So, yeah, any other favorites? Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 A Grief Observed, if you don't know, is basically a journal he kept after his wife died. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about his wife in a minute, a really cool story about how his wife came to faith in Christ. And he published it as N.W. Clerk, and which the first part of that N.W., Nat Wilk, it means I know not or unknown, and then Clerk, the author is unknown. And so it was kind of funny that some of the people, he published this journal after his wife died, and some of the people who were ministering to C.S. Lewis brought him this book by N.W. Clerk called A Grief Observed, because we think it could really help you through this time of crisis. And but in a short amount of time, people picked up on it that this was C.S. Lewis's writings, and after he died, it was published under his name. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah, The Problem of Pain. That was his first. The Problem of Pain, I think, is in many ways his most important book, because that's what James Welch, who was the over religious broadcasting for the BBC, read that, and that's what led to Mere Christianity. And so most people don't know that's one of his lesser known works, but that's really the one that started it all. So, in fact, in the back of The Problem of Pain, his doctor, Dr. Havard, who he also called, he had a nickname for him, he called him the useless quack. And he and his brother would abbreviate the name to UQ for useless quack. And Dr. Havard wrote an appendix, and it's the physiology of pain. And on one occasion, Lewis was at Dr. Havard there for a medical visit and was complaining about his pain, and which Lewis lived with chronic pain throughout his lifetime. And as he was complaining, Dr. Havard went over to his drawer, pulled out a copy of C.S. Lewis's book, The Problem of Pain, and just handed it to him as a way to say, take your own medicine, you know. All right, I'll try not to give you a story about every book, but it's kind of fun. All right, any other favorites? Okay, great. Yeah, so I love, that's my favorite of the Narnia ones, is Magician's Nephew. If you've not read all the Narnia stories, when you get to The Magician's Nephew, I didn't realize it was a prequel when I first read through them. And the order of the Chronicles of Narnia, which we don't have time to talk about today, the order is really interesting. And there's a scholar who came out recently, and in the medieval mind, there were seven different main planets, and that Lewis actually used that as a structure for his books. It's a guy named Michael Ward from Cambridge University who published that book. So, yeah, good. Perelandra, very cool. So you like the sci-fi stuff. Yeah, yeah. So C.S. Lewis's sci-fi, and this is apologetics related. If you look at some of Lewis's essays at the same time he wrote the sci-fi trilogy, Lewis was concerned with the real possibility that we would discover life on other planets. And so it was about that time that the Russians first sent a man into space. And so Lewis was writing about this, preparing Christians for what it would be like if we did indeed find human life on other planets, or alien life. And so the sci-fi trilogy was a work of apologetics. And you can go back and find essays that really parallel in a more explicitly Christian way what he was trying to do. And one of the things he says is, if we find life on other planets, first of all, God's not entitled to tell us that he created life on other planets. So that wouldn't disprove the Bible just because we find it. And that's what some atheists were saying. If we find life on other planets, the Bible must not be true because it doesn't mention it. But the other thing he says that he deals with in the trilogy is they may not be fallen. We may get to another planet and assume they're like us, and they may be this pre-fallen race, and we could mess things up for them. And so he plays that out in a really creative way in the sci-fi trilogy. All right, any other favorites? Anybody like his literary stuff? He had what he called the O'Hell Project. It was the Oxford History of English Literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. And it had a nice abbreviation, O-H-E-L, and he called it the O'Hell Project. It took him most of his lifetime. He read in the Oxford University Library everything written in the 16th century that was in their library, one of the most prestigious libraries on the planet, everything. And if it was a major work, he would write an essay on it, and he would put it in a file, and a year later he would grade it. And if he gave himself anything other than an A, he would go back and reread it, write an essay, wait a year, and then reevaluate how he did. So he's an impressive man with a really impressive mind. And what I want to share with you in our time is three arguments that permeate C.S. Lewis's writings. But before I do that, and I'll tell you what the arguments are, and then I'm going to tell you a story and I'll come back and unpack the arguments. So the first argument we'll consider is C.S. Lewis's argument from longing or desire. His argument from longing or desire. The second, and if you're taking notes, I'll come back and hit these again, so don't feel the need to rush through these, is his argument from morality. C.S. Lewis's argument from morality. And then the final one we're going to deal with, which is actually related to why C.S. Lewis did not write for Christianity Today's inaugural edition, was his argument from rationality. His argument from rationality. All right, so here's a cool story about C.S. Lewis. One of his literary mentors was a guy that I don't believe he ever met. I can't find where they met or even where they corresponded, but he's one of my favorite authors by the name of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. G.K. Chesterton was a jolly, plump British journalist who always looked grumpy. And every picture of him, he just had kind of a scowl on his face, but he was actually known for the opposite, for being really jovial and friendly and fun-loving, and he loved kids. He and his wife never had children themselves. But C.S. Lewis felt like G.K. Chesterton. In fact, Lewis said that Chesterton's book, more than any other work, influenced his conversion to Christianity, to theism and then Christianity. So G.K. Chesterton, what I love about him, he was a journalist, he was a Christian apologist, he wrote dramas, he wrote poetry, he wrote all kinds of stuff. In fact, Chris Hitchens, the famous atheist, the last essay Chris Hitchens wrote on his deathbed was an essay published about 2 months after he died in The Atlantic, and it was an essay on G.K. Chesterton. He read almost everything Chesterton wrote, not everything, but thousands of pages of Chesterton, because Chesterton wrote a ton of books. And here's Chris Hitchens on his deathbed reading the very man that contributed to Lewis's conversion. Now, I'm not suggesting a deathbed conversion. We have no evidence to believe that happened with Hitchens. But I do think in the providence of God that this man, dying of cancer, who's denied God throughout his lifetime, is reading from the very pages that led to the conversion of C.S. Lewis. So Chesterton was friends with skeptics and atheists. In fact, he was not only like evangelistically connected to them, he enjoyed having dinners with them. He enjoyed spending time with them. And then they would make fun of each other in print. And so he spent time with people like H.G. Wells. What's H.G. Wells known for? Yeah, War of the Worlds. And most people don't realize H.G. Wells was an outspoken atheist, was a philosopher, and he actually published what is called The Outline of Human History, a multi-volume history of all of humanity. Well, if you're an atheist and you give an outline of human history, then it's going to give an outline of an atheistic worldview, right? So there's a young girl in the Bronx in New York. She had a photographic memory. Her dad made her read H.G. Wells, The Outline of Human History, at the age of 8. And she announced after reading H.G. Wells' work that she had committed herself to atheism as an 8-year-old. Now, to go back to Britain, where H.G. Wells wrote The Outline of Human History, and he had the good friend G.K. Chesterton, G.K. Chesterton wrote a response to H.G. Wells' The Outline of Human History, And the title of G.K. Chesterton's book, anybody have a guess? The Everlasting Man. So The Everlasting Man is a response to H.G. Wells. Okay, move over in another part of England, not London, but Oxford. C.S. Lewis picks up The Everlasting Man, G.K. Chesterton's response to H.G. Wells. And Lewis converts from atheism to theism. Lewis goes on to write The Problem of Pain, which we've already talked about, which becomes extremely influential back in that home in the Bronx. He goes on to write Mere Christianity. And that young girl who became an atheist at the age of 8 by the name of Helen becomes a Christian because of the result of C.S. Lewis's writings, which were a result of G.K. Chesterton's writings, which was a response to H.G. Wells' book, which ultimately initiated her atheism. She would go on to move to England and become C.S. Lewis's wife, Helen Joy Davidman Lewis. And so it's interesting to see how it all comes full circle in the providence of God. And that's why I think even in our day like today, when we see books like The God Delusion, to know that God will use even those things to bring glory to himself in the way that he used H.G. Wells' The Outline of Human History to lead to G.K. Chesterton's book, even so in our day, God's going to use all things for his glory. But I think that's an interesting story about Lewis, and now I'm going to dive into some of his arguments. Stop me if you have questions, and I'll indeed take questions at the end. But if you have questions along the way, let me know. Okay, I'm going to spend the bulk of the time on the last argument. But let's start with the argument from desire. C.S. Lewis uses something, and I've never heard anyone else use this term, so perhaps I'll trademark it or something to protect it. But he uses what I would call imaginative apologetics. Imaginative apologetics. And even on this campus, I've had people say to me things like, well, I don't find some of C.S. Lewis's main arguments that compelling. And I could see why they say that. Because Lewis didn't just aim for the head in a cognitive sense. He was able to touch people's imagination. And I actually think that that's one of the reasons his influence is so lasting. That Lewis gave people a way to envision a God they couldn't see. That Lewis was able to make it real and palpable, something they could touch and something that resonated with their own day-to-day experience. And I think this is nowhere more else more clearly seen than in his longing from desire. He once talked about Christian joy this way. He said it's like the scent of a rose that you've never found. It's like the echo of a tune that you've never known, or news from a land that you've never visited. And what he meant by that is there's this something about the human experience that we're always longing for something right out of our grasp. That there's something in us that from time to time we'll be surprised by, as Lewis said in his spiritual autobiography, surprised by joy. There will be something that will strike us and make us long for transcendence and long for something that seems always evasive. And then Lewis even said, when you're looking for it, you can't get it. It's almost when you're looking in the wrong direction and not thinking about it, the joy sneaks up on you. He described it this way in a quote that I really like from him. If I find in myself a desire, and this really summarizes this argument, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. And what Lewis was talking about, a philosopher named Peter Kraft, who's a Catholic philosopher at Boston College in Boston, Massachusetts, has outlined this way. And so let me give you the way Kraft outlines this argument. He gives two premises and a conclusion. So here's the first premise. Every natural, innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire. Every natural, so he's making a distinction here between natural desires and unnatural ones. Every natural, innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire. Now, I don't want to move too quickly and assume that you understand that statement, so let me get some response from you. What does he mean by that? Yeah. So hunger, is hunger a universal desire? How many of you are hungry right now? Okay, most of you, which means I need to keep this short. So natural desires like hunger, can we deny that hunger is real? Can we deny it, just theoretically? Okay. Yeah, try it. Deny that hunger is real. Yeah, so you could, right? So theoretically, we could deny. But what would argue against that? What would stand in the face of that argument that hunger is unreal? What's that? Oh, I thought you said gas. Trying to figure that one out. Okay, so we would die ultimately, and that would prove. All right, somebody else respond to that. Okay, known experience. So we could argue against it all day long, but staring us in the face is going to be our real lived experience. And so what are some other natural desires? So we said hunger. What's that? Love. Okay. We could deny that that's real, but what would be staring us in the face is universal human experience, right? I mean, you could say, I don't need love, but you still put deodorant on, right? Unless you're a junior high boy, no offense. You'll get there. We all want to be loved, even though you could deny it. There are certain things like reality, it would seem, that argue against your argument, that are pretty compelling counterarguments. So hunger, love, thirst, okay? I know it's a mixed audience in different ages, but the desire for sex is a physical, natural desire that is God-given, that not only has a desire, but has a way for that to be satisfied. With hunger, there's food. With water, or with thirst, there's water. So the first premise is every natural, innate desire. What's innate mean? Okay, so it's from within, and we're built this way. So if it's innate, it's not something we gain through time. It's a part of who we are. So a natural thing that is also innate. Every natural innate desire in us corresponds, what's the word correspond mean here? To write letters back and forth? Yeah, it's linked together. So a natural innate desire is linked to something real that can satisfy that desire. Is that true? It's a philosophical question, isn't it? Yeah, it certainly seems to be true. Can you give me scientific evidence of that? Okay. Yeah. See, Lewis, and in one sense, we could say it's not a scientific argument, right? It's an argument from human experience. There's a book, and I'll get to the second premise in a second. It's called The Atheist Guide to Reality. And it was a couple of years ago, someone at a talk like this introduced me to that book. I hadn't read it yet. It's by a guy named Alex Rosenberg. And he says if naturalism is true, that there's nothing outside of nature, then we need to just come to grips with that fact and quit living with illusions. Well, if that's true, he's right. Right? He says, we don't need wishful thinking. We just need to come to grips with the facts. Does wishful thinking make something true? Is that what Lewis is talking about, wishful thinking? Okay, put a pin in that. We'll come back to it in a second. So here's what Rosenberg does. He goes on in the book to say, there's only science. And to quote Bertrand Russell, well-known atheistic scientist, Bertrand Russell said, what science cannot teach us, man cannot know. Really? Did you discover that under a microscope or through a telescope? Is that a scientific statement? It's a philosophical one. And so, but Rosenberg accepts that basic kind of way of thinking about life. We can only understand. In fact, he has a central premise of his book, and it's this. Physics fixes the facts. And at the end of the book, he says, there's no such thing as self. There's no such thing as personhood. When you think you're thinking about things, you're really not. That's a trick your brain's playing on you. He says the idea of free will is an illusion. So we just do what our brains tell us to do, and we can't control our brain. And there's a number of things. He says morality is an illusion. And so what he says is, We need to quit living with wishful thinking. Here's the problem. What stares in the face of that? Our lived experience. You want to know what else stares in the face of that? Rosenberg wrote a book. He was thinking about it. And it was him who wrote it. And you want to know why he wrote it? To change minds. But how can you change your mind if there's nothing non-physical outside of your mind? Right? I can only do what my brain tells me to do, and I can't have something outside of it to act within it. What is the main compelling argument against Rosenberg? I think it's the human experience. And that's what C.S. Lewis is saying here, that with every desire, there's something that corresponds to it. Here's the second premise. But there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, and no creature can satisfy. Let me read it again. But there exists, this is the second premise of his argument, there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, and no creature can satisfy. So the first premise, every natural innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy that desire. Premise number two, but there is a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, and no creature can satisfy. Now let's take into account here that 99% of the people alive right now and 99% of the people who've ever lived on this planet have longed for transcendence. I mean, if you look at Western culture, there's a disproportionate amount of atheists. Not only in Western culture, it's disproportionate in academia, but recognize that the vast majority of humans living on the planet, with the exception of within Western culture and in America in the academy, the vast majority of people recognize freely that there's a God and long to know God, that this is common to the human experience. And Lewis is saying, if there's a desire, there's something that corresponds to, if it's a natural desire, but there seems to be in us a natural desire that nothing else can satisfy. And this leads to the conclusion, therefore, so premise one, premise two, conclusion, therefore there must exist something more than time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. Therefore, or if you want to be academic and snooty, you could use the Latin word ergo. Latin is the best way to be condescending, right? Ergo, therefore, or I guess for preachers is to drop some Greek or Hebrew. Therefore, there must exist something more than time, earth, and creatures which can satisfy this desire. Now let me read the premise, the two premises, and the conclusion again. Every natural innate desire in us corresponds to some real object that can satisfy the desire. Premise two, but there exists in us a desire which nothing in time, nothing on earth, and no creature can satisfy. Therefore, there must exist something more than earth, more than time, earth, and creatures. Lewis once observed the fact that we're always talking about how fast time flies. Always. I can't believe time has flown by. And Lewis said, it seems that there's a part of us that is timeless, that we're always so surprised. Why does time surprise us? There must be something in us. And you could say that's a weak argument. And I would just say any counter argument would stand, have to stare in the face like Alex Rosenberg does of universal human experience. This seems to be common to all people and therefore natural. And if every natural desire has an object that can satisfy it, it seems there must be something outside of nature that could satisfy this desire that nothing else in nature can satisfy. If you ever want to read a philosopher from a ton of years ago, from a long time ago, a few hundred years ago, read Pascal and read his Penzies. Penzies is French for thoughts. And it's just a journal, like C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed. It's a journal. And some of the stuff is brilliant, and some of it, you could tell he was just having a weird day. Like he says, when you sneeze, you lose a part of your soul in one of the entries. It's like, okay. You know, what do you do with the Kleenex then? I mean, and at the resurrection, you know, are all these molecules and Kleenexes where you go, I don't know. But what Pascal says is man's main problem is the fact that he's not happy and he won't deal with it. If you read throughout the book, you see Pascal says over and over again, our main problem is that we are constantly trying to amuse ourselves and distract ourselves from the reality that we're not happy. In fact, he says this. He said, if we were truly happy, why do we constantly try to distract ourselves? And he said, that's our main problem because it keeps us from dealing with the fact that, as he says in one place in the Penzies, that there's a God-sized vacuum, to paraphrase it, a God-sized hole that nothing else can fill except for God himself. That's exactly what C.S. Lewis was saying here. C.S. Lewis said, a baby feels hunger. There's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. There's such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there's such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. All right, any thoughts or comments before I move on to the next argument? What's that? Yeah, it's so if you've seen the movie with the Disney one with the little green thing, yeah, that's same name, Pascal, P-A-S-C-A-L, Pascal. And you can actually get it as a PDF online. And if you have Kindle or something like that, you can get it as a free ebook. So Pascal's my favorite philosopher, by the way. So, all right. Okay, the second thing is his argument from morality. And I want to just kind of talk to you about how Lewis would talk about it, and then I'm going to use a Christian apologist named William Lane Craig, the way he frames this argument. Now, Lewis would talk about the fact, and he does this in Mere Christianity, the fact that we have these different reflexes or responses, these natural ways that we respond to things in our life. So, for example, if you're walking down the street and you see a little old lady getting robbed at knife point, you're going to have something will happen with physiologically within your body. What do we call that response? Fight or flight. Okay, and that just means you either are going to fight the guy with the knife or you're going to run away. Adrenaline will start flooding your system. And Lewis said we encounter this on a regular basis. We'll come to a scenario and we'll have these kind of different desires, either to do the heroic thing or to do the self-preservation thing. I'm going to protect myself or I'm going to do something that seems to be right or noble or selfless, and we're kind of torn between those things. Well, human experience and science, I mean, science would show us there's a physiological effect that happens when we're faced with something like that. We know that's true. But Lewis says there's something else, and he talked about it as the third thing. Beyond these natural responses, these physiological responses, there's something that seeks to govern which one we choose, right? So I have a natural response, but then there seems to be a third thing that seeks to govern it. And if we actually listen to it and carefully cultivate a sensitive ear to listen to this third thing, we'll find that it almost always leads us to do the heroic thing. To where if we run away and the little lady gets stabbed or robbed or beaten up or whatever, we feel bad for that. So not only does it lead us to want to do the right thing, it actually tells us we're wrong when we don't do the right thing. And Lewis said that this points to a transcendent law that governs our natural responses. And William Lane Craig breaks it down this way. He gives two premises and a conclusion. And the first is this: if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. If God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Now, last night, Sean quoted the Russian author Dostoevsky, who said famously, if God does not exist, all things are permissible. There was to go way back into philosophy an early Greek philosopher by the name of Protagoras who made the comment, man is the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things. Now, that's kind of a creed for humanists today. What Dostoevsky seems to be true, if God doesn't exist, then there's no transcendent law to say that one thing's bad or another thing's right. There have been scientists and philosophers who've taken this seriously. There's one well-known scientist who came out not long ago with an article that says bestiality is not wrong. it's not wrong to have intimate relations with animals, that there's no objective standard to call that evil. That would have to be a really weird article to try and publish. But it seems to be true what Dostoevsky said, that if God does not exist, then everything's permissible. Does that mean people are going to be as bad as they can be? Well, total depravity teaches us. Actually, it doesn't teach us that, does it? The doctrine of total depravity, does it teach us that people will be as bad as they can be? It actually doesn't. It teaches us that everything they do and think is tainted by sin, but it's contrasted with another doctrine in Scripture, which is the fact that we are created in the image of God. And so we're not as bad as we can be, and yet we can never be good enough to know God. But if there is no God, there's no objective moral standard. So Protagoras, man is the measure of all things. We are the center point for our own morality. Morality is relative to our lived experience in community with other people. Let me give you one example. So my boys are seven. My twins are seven. They like to play Monopoly. Anybody else like to play Monopoly? Okay, anybody hate Monopoly? Thank you. It is such a commitment. You don't kind of play Monopoly, right? And so my boys like to play that, and they don't like to play the full game. They just want to get it out and play with the stuff and fight over who gets, you know, the dog or the shoe or whatever. Does that Monopoly money have value? They pull out. Does it have value? What determines its value? Context. Okay, some could say the creator of the game because they printed a number on there. But how many of you ever changed the rules of your board games? You have, what do we call those? we call them house rules. So in the context of my basement, the value of the Monopoly money is determined by the ones playing the game and according to our house rules. So it does have value. But if they took that money and they went down to the corner store and they wanted to buy a candy bar, could they buy that candy bar with that Monopoly money? Why not? Okay, it's not real money. So they might say, Daddy, can I have a candy bar? And if I am not worried about their dentist visit in the, you know, future days, I'll pull my wallet out and I'll pull out some green, which I would not actually pull out plastic. I pull out my debit card. But let's just say I pulled out a dollar bill, which would not be enough for a candy bar today, which is sad. So let's say I pulled out a $20 bill and I'm going to let them get a candy bar and a Coke because I really want their teeth to fall out. And would that $20 bill have value? Okay. What determines its value? Okay, the government? Okay. That's a complex answer, yeah. So what's behind that dollar bill that determines its value? Yeah, nothing. The President Obama. So there's a government backing. There's a reserve behind it that determines. But is the government backing subject to change as well? So does that dollar bill really have any more objective value than the Monopoly money? Okay. Now, here's my point. You can have values apart from God, but it's like the Monopoly money, or it's like the dollar bill. The only way it can have objective universal value is this: if it has a reserve that is transcendent and not subject to change. Does that make sense? And so what Lewis is arguing for morality is there seems to be something that's transcendent, that's not contingent upon whether or not we like it, that's not contingent upon whether or not enough people agree to it, that would say that the Nazis were wrong even if they were successful. There's an objective law that would judge them even if they were victorious. So the first premise, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. That doesn't mean there's not created morality that we can agree on, like Monopoly money. I'm just saying it's not objective and universal. Second objective, objective moral values and duties do exist. So the first premise, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. How do we know that? Can you prove that scientifically? Not really, right? It's the human experience. The human experience seems to teach us that there are some things that are moral. We intuitively know it. Now, the debate we hosted that I mentioned earlier, we brought in a Christian apologist. They brought in an atheist philosopher. And we flipped a coin to see who could go first. Some of you may have heard me give this illustration before. And the Christian apologist, Mark Coppinger, who's a professor here and a friend, won the toss and he went first. And he stood up and he said, and the subject of the debate was, can you be good without God? That was the topic, morality and God. And so Mark Coppinger got up and he said, can you be good without God? Yes. Now I'm sitting on the front row and I'm one of the main organizers of this debate. And I brought him in as a Christian. And I'm like, oh, debate's over. Christian apologist said, yeah, you don't need God to be good. And he gave this example, and I thought it was really powerful. He said, everyone here is good with a little g, but you can't be good with a capital G. And he said, let me ask you this. He said, you know, we know that everybody here has a moral standard. You all have different morals. They differ slightly. Some people would say that marriage is reserved for a man and a woman for a lifetime commitment. Some people wouldn't say that, but you still value certain things like love and commitment. So there, and I'm not saying that's a minor difference, but he was saying in a room like this that at that time was filled primarily with skeptics, everybody has a moral code. Even though it's slightly different, it's mostly the same, right? And he asked the question, he said, how many of you live perfectly up to your moral code? Your own code, not somebody else's, yours. How many of you perfectly fulfill it? Of course, he didn't ask him to raise hands. The answer to that is no one. And he said, you know what you need? You need someone who can obtain moral perfection on your behalf and impute that or transfer that into your account to be good with a big G. Does that make sense? And that's basically what the gospel is. And so the second premise is this. There are objective moral values. We recognize them. We live in such a way. And so the conclusion is, therefore, ergo, God exists. Let me give you both premise again, the premises, and then I'll give you the conclusion. And then I'll just see if you have a response, and we'll move on to the next one, which led to why C.S. Lewis did not write for Christianity Today. So, first premise, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Okay, I think that is hard to refute on atheism. I had one friend say to me, well, it's like a chess game. In chess, we have objective rules, right? And so morality could be like that. We created the game of chess. We created the objective rules. And so in chess, sometimes you'll sacrifice a pawn in order to win the game. So on that, we would recognize that there would be certain problems with that. And you might even, in a really extreme case, you might even sacrifice the queen in order to win. You might have some bizarre thing. But it's man-made rules. And it's not, I think it illustrates Craig's point that if God does not exist, the best we could do is contrive together these rules that we seem to agree with. So if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. We say things like right and wrong. That's right, that's wrong. C.S. Lewis said that his main argument against God was that there is so much evil in the world. How many of you have heard an argument like that? There's too much evil in the world. And he goes on to say, but I realized that I had to adopt a transcendent standard in order to declare that there was evil in the world. And he said, in the end, I realized that if I let go of God, I had to let go of my idea of justice. I couldn't have one without the other. And so if I give up God, I have to give up a standard of justice. But I need a standard of justice to call the world evil in order to say there is no God. I can't get rid of it. You have to get rid of both. And some philosophers are able and willing to do just that. Richard Dawkins has argued in an article that's called the Faulty Car. He argues that you wouldn't drive down the road and your car breaks down. You wouldn't get out of your car with a baseball bat and begin to punish your car. That would be silly. Now, people do that, especially men probably more than women. But Dawkins says it doesn't make sense to punish your car. Why would you do that? And why would you punish a person? Sam Harris argues in his book, he's a well-known atheist, his book Free Will, he talks about two men who go into a house. There's a family there. The dad's sleeping on the back deck or in the screened-in room on a wicker couch. They take a hammer and they hit him in the head. They think they've killed him. They go upstairs and they find the wife and the two daughters, and they tie the daughters to their beds. They take the wife to the bank and they empty her bank account. They bring her home. They have their way with all three of them. They are tied to their bed and they set their beds on fire. And they leave. And Sam Harris says they are just doing what their brains have told them to do, and they are not morally responsible. They are not. And he says, if I had their brain, I would have done what they did. But we're appalled by that. Why are we appalled? Because objective moral values and duties do exist. And if there wasn't a God, you couldn't have them. But there are moral values. There are objective moral values and duties. Therefore, God exists. All right. Before I move on to the next one, thoughts or comments, questions? Yes. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and it's primarily because it's connected today to secularism. And so it's humanism apart from God. I would argue for a gospel-grounded humanism. And the way I would say it is that the gospel provides an exclusive foundation for human flourishing. That we can only have a true humanism if the gospel's true. If there's not a transcendent but personal God, then there's no good reason for us to think that humanism is morally binding for anyone other than ourselves. At the end of the day, we'd have to ask, why would that be the case? So humanism in and of itself isn't bad. Most people, I've met with the secular humanist chaplain at Yale University, a guy named Chris Stedman, who's a really good guy, published a book recently called Faithiest. He's both an atheist and an outspoken advocate for the lesbian, gay, LGBT, whatever the other letters they've added on. I admire much of what he does. But like what Francis Schaeffer said, the secular humanist has their feet firmly planted in midair because there's no foundation to support them. So I would argue for humanism, but I would argue that it's the gospel that gives a foundation for beauty. Why should we care about art on a purely Darwinian evolutionary standpoint? We could care about it, but we have no foundation for it. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I would almost say it's kind of the opposite. So not that you would apply Buddhism to humanism. I think humanism is actually an outgrowth of Christian values. And so, and Schaeffer, to quote Francis Schaeffer again, are you familiar with Schaeffer at all? He's a Christian philosopher. And he said that the humanists live on borrowed capital. And what he means by that is they borrowed certain values from a Christian worldview, and that's what they esteem and put forward, but they don't have a foundation for them. They don't have an explanation for them. Yeah, good question. Any other questions before we move on? Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that I have a good canned answer because a lot of those conversations, and I'm in the middle of one even this week on this very topic, and it gets messy. And so a lot of times people say, well, evolution doesn't work that way. And I think what Sean did, his response last night was good to say, well, we all just recognize that that's wrong. You know, we know it's wrong to go in and rape and kill these women and try to kill the father. He survived. We just kind of know it's wrong. And I don't think that they would feel a need to satisfy your desire to ground morality in an objective source. So my skeptic friends will say, I don't know that morality needs to be grounded. And then the challenge would be, says who? If it doesn't need to be grounded, then what about when someone else's morality infringes on your morality? And we had a question, and I don't know if this will touch on your question at all. But I asked my friend who's actually pro-choice, and I said, so if your wife is married, if she went into delivery early and your child was preborn and needed a lot of medical care, would you feel that the hospital was morally responsible to do all they could to care for that baby? And he said, absolutely. And so even within that, there's this tension between it would be okay for someone to terminate that life, but they would be morally responsible to care for his child. So I don't think that a lot of people feel like they have to satisfy all those questions in their own moral mindset. Does that make sense? I probably didn't answer your question, but I tried. All right, any other questions? All right, yeah. 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 And then, of course, that's a long debate about nature or nurture. And so Sam Harris is a neuroscientist, and there's a lot of controversy between philosophers and neuroscientists today. And so if you look at a lot of recent books by neurosurgeons or neuroscientists, they'll argue that essentially that we can't control our brains and that our brains tell us what to do. And then there are philosophers who will say, you know, who don't accept that kind of reductionism. And so even if it's just nurture, that doesn't make it morally binding. If it's just nurture, then what the Germans were doing could be justified within that environment. And so there seems to be something in us that longs for this universal standard to call the Holocaust objectively evil. And if it's just nurture, then there's no basis for which to do that. So, all right. So I'm going to move to the next one. Here's what I don't want you to do. And I think Sean did a good job of giving you this admonition. And that's not to think that getting a 5-minute soundbite explanation from a professor adequately equips you to go into the secular student society and refute everyone's argument. I argue all the time for evangelism with skeptics that it's a lifelong commitment to be done in the context of a loving relationship. So don't leave here and want to go do like drive-by evangelism. You know, I got this soundbite from Sean McDowell or Dan DeWitt or Dr. Mueller, and I'm just going to just spray everybody in the audience with it. These are things you have to work through and think through yourself, and the best way to share them with others is a long, committed, respectful relationship. And I had a missionary to the Middle East who encouraged me in my ministry at the University of Louisville, and he said that your ministry with skeptics is a lot like my ministry with Muslims. He says just a very long life commitment. And I'll say one thing and I'll move on to the final argument, which I'll spend little time on because we've used most of our time. So don't spaz out. I told you to be the longest. I won't make it the longest. But your commitment to skeptics needs to transcend your desire to see them quickly converted. Your commitment to them needs to be so great, even if they don't get converted in a year or 2 years or a decade or 3 decades or never, that you're committed to them. And if your commitment to them is tied to them accepting Christ, they will see through that in a heartbeat. That's why Francis Schaeffer said, our lifestyle is our final apologetic. Apologetic means an argument for the gospel. And Schaeffer said, you want to know what your last and most compelling argument for the gospel is? Your lifestyle. Here's the final argument from Lewis, and it's a big one, but we'll spend just a little bit of time on it. And it's the argument from rationality. So C.S. Lewis published a book in response to Dorothy Sayers, who was a British, one of the first female graduates from Oxford University, really articulate lady, defender of the faith, and she had an atheist friend, and she didn't have time to deal with him. In fact, she wrote C.S. Lewis, and she said, "I'm going to put him off on you because you care for souls and I don't," which is pretty brass, but I think she was joking. And in that letter, she said he's always referencing miracles. I wish someone would write a Christian apologetic for miracles. And so C.S. Lewis did it. He wrote a book called Miracles. It's one of my favorite of C.S. Lewis's apologetic works. And that book, Miracles, he actually debated with a philosopher named G.E. Anscombe. G.E. Anscombe, I think. She had several initials. She was a philosopher, and one person who was at the event said, standing there smoking her cigar, she looked confident she had won the debate. That's a mental image. And they debated the book of miracles, and specifically they debated the third chapter. And in the third chapter, C.S. Lewis makes an argument, and I'll condense it for you. It's something I hope you think about. In fact, not to be self-promoting, but I wrote an article on this at my blog, and you can get it there. It's my blog is Theo, like theology, and Latte, like Starbucks, Theo Latte. So if you go to theolatte.com, there's an article. It's about the third down, and it's called The 100-Year Argument, or Happy Birthday to the 100-Year-Old Argument. So C.S. Lewis borrowed from a book that he really appreciated that was from a lecture given in 1914 from the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom named James Balfour. He was giving a lecture in which he was arguing that only Christianity gives an objective basis for humanism. The title of the book is Theism and Humanism. And he argues in that book that only in Christianity do you actually find a transcendent source in which to ground our value system. And the biggest one, he says, is our confidence that we place in our own mind. And so I want to read you just a couple paragraphs from this lecture given in 1914, 100 years ago, that became a book a year later that C.S. Lewis quotes from in his book, Miracles. And here it is. "But knowledge, the department of human interest to which I now turn..." We have 10 more minutes, so hang with me. "But knowledge, the department of human interest to which I now turn, is differently placed. The values with which we shall be concerned are mainly rational, and intellectual curiosity is the only emotion with which they are associated. Yet, here also two questions arise corresponding to those which we have already dealt with in a different connection. Here they are. First, what are the causes of our knowledge? Or what part of our knowledge, which concerns the world of common sense of science? What are the causes of our knowledge? Okay, second question. Does the naturalistic or atheistic account of these causes affect the rational value of our thoughts?" So his two questions he asks and seeks to answer is, what are the causes of our knowledge? And the second, does the causes from an atheistic worldview affect the value of our knowledge? If this is like flying over your head, here's essentially what he means. If atheism is true, then that means everything that's happened is a product of matter and has come about over a long period through the process of evolution by accident. So the cause of our knowledge is linked all the way back to an accident. And he asks the question, does that affect the value of our knowledge? To which he says the answer is yes. Let me give you one quick example of this. C.S. Lewis said that you wouldn't expect to spill a bottle of milk in it to form a map of London. You wouldn't expect that to happen, right? Because accidents usually do not give you valid information. And so what James Balfour is saying that Lewis argues for in Miracles is that if our information is the result of an accident, it is not trustworthy. And I'll give you one example, and then we'll see if you have any questions, and we'll break. How many of you have heard the argument that religion is a product of evolution? How many of you have seen that, read it, kind of heard it, okay? You hear it all the time. In fact, some people say that God is a product of evolution, that not that he's actually real, but our view of God. So I had a friend, and we were talking about this, and he says, you know, religion is just the result of evolution. Evolution has led us to religious beliefs, and now we've evolved past that. We no longer need God. And so using Balfour's argument, not like the gotcha moment, but using Balfour's argument, I said to him, if that's true, it proves two things. The first thing it proves is that religion is false. Right? If religion is the product of evolution, religion is false. Would everybody agree with that? I'm just saying if. And the second thing it proves is evolution doesn't care about leading us to true beliefs. Right? If evolution has led the majority of people in all places at all times, with the exception of Western culture and in America, the academy, to believe there's a God, then we can know that religion is false and evolution is not trustworthy. Yeah. That's right. And that's why C.S. Lewis says, you know, if on this central point that sometimes the skeptic will throw up our hands and say, we're not primarily concerned with truth. And C.S. Lewis says in Miracles, why didn't you tell me that from the beginning? Because this whole thing's about truth. And he says, they'll admit in this moment, there's not good reason to think they have attained truth. They'll admit, they'll concede it. And then after the conversation's over, they pick it back up and continue to function as if they have good reason to trust their mental faculties. And I'll close with this. There's an atheist philosopher named Thomas Nagel at the University of New York who in 1997 published a book called The Last Word, in which he said, some of the smartest people I know are religious believers. It's not just that I don't believe there's a God. I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that. He just published a book this last year with Oxford University Press after spending a lot of time dealing with this argument, this very argument, who is, it's now the biggest advocate for today, is a guy named Alvin Plantinga. And the title of the argument's interesting. Here's the title. It's The Evolutionary Argument Against Naturalism. The Evolutionary Argument Against Naturalism. If evolution is true and our mind is the product of accidents, there's no good reason to trust our mind. And so it seems that there's something more than nature. So Thomas Nagel, who's an atheist, published a book last year by Oxford University Press, and the title of his book is this, and I'll leave you with it. He's still an atheist. The title is this, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Neo-Darwinian Materialistic Picture of the Universe is Almost Certainly False. And in the book, he says there has to be something guiding evolution, because if everything is an accident, then my brain is an accident. And if my brain is an accident, I have no good reason to trust it. And if I have no good reason to trust it, it doesn't matter how many arguments I come up with, because they're coming from the same source, which is an effect of a cause, which was an accident. And so C.S. Lewis used that argument. In the debate, he felt humiliated because he felt like he was defeated, some people said. But he came back even stronger. He edited the chapter and republished the book. And the argument still stands today. I believe it's one of his most powerful apologetics, is the argument from rationality. All right, it's time for lunch, so I'm going to dismiss you. Thank you for your time. I know I hit you with a lot of information. Hope it was helpful. Have a good day.